You're worried about being cool, because I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but I happen to think I'm very cool. Hey, I said as casually as I could, were you in Dundrummond Thursday? A pause. Why? Liz let it slip that she saw you. What else did she say? That seemed like a strange follow-up question, and Will's tone was disconcertingly cautious. That you two had lunch? I said. What? Will cursed. We didn't have lunch. No? I thought you were going to say that she told you what I got you for Christmas. No, I just ran into her. In the middle of the shopping centre. She was with that Lauren girl. They were going to Penny's to look for Santa jumpers or something. I had your present in a bag and... Well, it was obvious what it was from the bag. But I asked her not to tell you. I didn't want her ruining the surprise. But lunch? Bloody hell. I talked to her for maybe a minute and then I went on my way. I was trying to get back to meet you after your Victorian lit class. And he had. He'd been waiting for me outside my last class. It was off campus, in rooms in a converted Georgian house that was mostly used for postgraduate study. He didn't like me walking back after it by myself in the dark. Are you sure that's what she said? Were you looking for a ski jacket? Yeah, but they didn't have my size in stock. Oh, it's crazy that she would say that. He swore again. Us having lunch? As if. I mean, what the... Yeah, I said lamely. I didn't know what else to say, but I knew who I believed. So what the hell was Liz up to? The next morning, Liz and I took the train down to Cork together, but didn't speak much. She dozed and I read. We were used to sitting together in cars, buses and trains, in companionable silence, so I doubted she sensed that there was any motivation behind mine. Everything had changed so much in the last 3 months. My head was spinning. I thought back to when we'd travelled up to Dublin back in September, the palpable excitement, that first night in St. John's, and I thought of what lay ahead of me, nearly a month without Will. The idea set me adrift, which was so strange when, 12 weeks ago, I hadn't even known he'd existed. I hung around the house my first couple of days back, deeply appreciating the ease with which things could happen. There was always food in the fridge. There was never anyone in my way in the kitchen. My dirty clothes magically disappeared from the laundry basket in my room, and I didn't have to worry about having clean towels or toilet paper or toothpaste. Mam was on hand to make endless cups of tea. She even brought them when I didn't ask for them. Everything was already there, supplied. I basked in this, took advantage of it, lazing around reading novels belonging to my mother that had absolutely nothing to do with the St. John's curriculum, and tucking into the boxes of chocolates she'd stocked up on for Christmas. On my third day at home, I stepped out of the shower to hear voices in the kitchen. I paused at the top of the stairs listening, but I couldn't identify who my mother was talking to. Then I heard the high pitch of Liz's laugh. I hurried down, worried that she might have already said something that would reveal Will's existence to my mother. I wasn't ready for that. I wasn't sure my mother was ready for that. She seemed to think Dublin was a den of iniquity, where only the mortal sins await. A boyfriend to her would be proof of that. She'd say I was there for a degree, not unplanned pregnancy. I knew that'd be her first thought, and my cheeks burned hot at the idea of discussing that with her. No, not yet. She needed to be primed for it. I had a plan. Come January, I'd start dropping his name into conversation, telling my mother about Will was on my things to worry about in the New Year list. Not today's. Hello, stranger, Liz said when I entered the kitchen. I'm heading into town for a walk around. You want to come? Of course she does, my mother said. Be careful, though, because the oxygen might go to her head. She hasn't left the house in 2 days. I rolled my eyes. I could just go back to Dublin if it's bothering you. Off with you then, love. You'll have to wait for me to dry those 4 loads of wet clothes first, though. You can't pack them wet. Liz looked away, biting back laughter. I made her wait upstairs with me while I got changed and dried my hair, just to be on the safe side. She had her mother's car with her. We parked in Merchant's Quay and started down Patrick Street, pushing against a tide of Christmas shoppers. Liz's mother had given her a list of things to pick up. Compared to Dublin, Cork seemed impossibly tiny now, especially when we started bumping into people we knew. I had never, in all the time I'd lived in Dublin, bumped into anyone I knew accidentally, except for Will in that cafe in Ranelagh, and he'd admitted that it wasn't entirely accidental. Here you couldn't move for people you knew popping up at random. Worse than that, though, was being seen by people who knew you, but who you didn't know, like friends of your parents. It meant you could never get away with anything. We were browsing the racks in River Island when a familiar voice said hello. When we turned around, two girls we'd gone to school with were standing there. One of them was Sharon, who'd had the CAO offers party that I hadn't gone to because I'd thought Liz was in a sulk. The other one was a girl called Amanda, who had been in another class, who I only knew from seeing around. We chatted for a few minutes about how college was going, for them and for us, and how Dublin was compared to Galway, where Sharon was. Then Sharon turned to me and said, "And I heard you have a boyfriend. Louise is in Trinity, and she knows his friend Matt," she said. "Does he have a friend called Matt?" I said he'd mentioned that name a couple of times. A school friend, I thought. "Well, I only heard good things. Lou says he's hot." She looked to Liz. "Is he hot? There's no point in asking her because we know what she's going to say." Liz hesitated. "Well, he's not my type, but..." Sharon laughed and said to me, "I suppose that's just as well, isn't it?" I forced a smile. I was thinking, "He's not your type. What's that supposed to mean?" "He's skiing," Liz said pointedly, loading the word with meaning. None of us had ever been, or knew anyone who had.
"Doesn't everyone in St. John's do that?"
Amanda said slyly. "You two will have to start." St. John's had a reputation for educating the kids of the upper classes, the ones decked out in designer threads, kept in Volkswagen Golfs, and taken skiing every winter. It deserved this. Those kids were there, but they were just one part of the student body. It was an image St. John's couldn't possibly shake, though, being situated in the most expensive postcode in the country, Dublin 4. Will came from a family like that, from what I could gather, but you'd never know. He never acted like he was any different to the rest of us.
"What about you, Liz?"
Sharon asked.
"Me?"
Liz raised her eyebrows.
"Skiing?"
"No, boyfriends."
I don't think so."
Liz made a face like she'd just sucked on a lemon. "Being stuck in someone else's pocket, like, all the time. Never going anywhere without them. Never wanting to go anywhere without them." She sighed dramatically.
"God, no. That'd drive me insane. No thanks."
My face was rapidly colouring.
"Jeez," Sharon said. "Tell us how you really feel."
She and Amanda exchanged a glance. We said our goodbyes and made vague promises to arrange something for Stephen's night. As Liz and I walked out of the store back onto the street, I was overwhelmed with a sad, dense anger. Liz was chatting away oblivious about some top she'd seen and how it'd be perfect to wear on New Year's Eve, as if she hadn't just cruelly and casually insulted me, and I just couldn't stand it a second longer. "I'm going home," I announced abruptly. "I don't feel well." Liz swung around to face me.
"What?"
"I have a headache. It's been building up all morning, but now it's making me feel a bit sick. I think I'm getting my period. I just want to go home to bed."
"Oh, shit. Well, that's okay. Let's head back towards the car."
"No, no," I said quickly. "You have to get that stuff for your mother, don't you? I'll just take the bus."
"Don't be silly, we'll just..."
"No." Liz blinked at me. "No," I said again more evenly this time. "It's fine, really. I'll just get the bus. It stops practically outside my door. Honestly, it's fine. I'll call you later."
"Okay."
Liz sounded uncertain. I gave her a limp hug and then turned off Patrick Street, heading for the bus stops on the South Mall. With steam coming out of my ears, I was sure. I was just so tired of this, of Liz's little mood swings. When she was happy, she was such fun to be around. We were best friends, really. I felt better after she'd been around. But if Liz wasn't happy, if she was in one of her inexplicable moods,
I either felt like I had to walk on eggshells around her, or that I was the prime target on her warpath, or sometimes both. And it was one thing when she worked her little digs into our private conversations, but to so blatantly insult me in front of other people. That was it. Limit reached. Line crossed. I just missed a bus. I found some cold stone steps leading to a closed bank branch and sat in them to wait for the next one. A few minutes later I heard, "Alison? Well, hello again." Sharon and Amanda. Done with their shopping and headed home too. They asked me where Liz had disappeared to, and I explained that I wasn't feeling well and had elected to go home. "Headache," I said, rubbing my temple for effect. Amanda fished in her bag and handed me 2 ibuprofen in a blister pack. Sharon had a few mouthfuls left in a bottle of water. I couldn't very well refuse, so I took them and thanked them. I'd nearly convinced myself that I was getting a headache anyway. "So what's he like then?" Sharon said. "Will, isn't it? I heard he's a really nice guy." I said he was. I told them how we met. "Listen," Amanda said, leaning closer. "Don't worry about her, okay? She's always been a bit of a jellyfish." Sharon threw Amanda a sharp look. "What? It's not like she doesn't know it. She can't not. She just got stung herself. We were there." It took me a second to figure out what she was talking about. "You mean Liz?" "Look," Sharon said, digging Amanda lightly in the ribs. "Ignore us. She's your best friend." I looked to Amanda. "What's a jellyfish?" The two girls exchanged another glance. "It's when you have a friend," Amanda said, "who is really nice, like, most of the time, but then they'll suddenly say something mean or rude, like a little jab, a little sting, and then they just carry on as if nothing has happened, and you're left there thinking, did something just happen, or am I imagining it? Didn't you ever see Bridget Jones?" "I like Liz," Sharon said. "She's a laugh, but she does do that." "A lot," Amanda added. Their bus came then. Mine was still another 10 minutes away. I thanked them for the painkillers and said I might see them around over the break. But I didn't see them or anyone else over the break. On Christmas Eve, I woke up with a stuffed nose, and by the morning of Stephen's Day, I was knocked out by full-blown flu. I realized pretty quickly that all the other times I'd thought I'd had the flu, I had, at worst, a heavy cold. This was something else entirely. Headaches, chills, sweats, a heavy pressure on my chest. After 2 really bad days of it, Mam rang our GP, who said yes, it was flu, and there was really nothing to do except take something with paracetamol in it to keep my temperature down, lie down, and wait for it to be over. The only saving grace was that I got it at home, where I was waited on hand and foot. I don't know how I would have coped at college. I commandeered the couch where I lay cocooned in a sea of pillows and blankets, presiding over a kingdom of pots of Vicks vapor rub, crumpled tissues, and half-drunk cups of tea. I read or napped during the day, and watched episodes of The West Wing with my parents at night. Mam had bought Dad the DVD box set for Christmas, and after a couple of episodes, we were all hooked. Mam would slip upstairs at some point to plug in the electric blanket for me. In the morning, she'd wake me with breakfast in bed and change the sheets while I showered. If it wasn't for constantly feeling like I'd been run over by a truck, I would have enjoyed it. I didn't see Liz at all, but we talked on the phone. Will called a couple of times, but on both occasions I was in the living room, and it was difficult to talk to him normally when my parents were within earshot, without giving something away. We constantly texted each other too. One day, while I was asleep, Liz called over and left a stack of glossy magazines with my mother. They were wrapped up like a present and had a gift tag that said, "Get well soon." It was my mother who eventually opened them and started leafing through the top one from the pile. My plan had been to go back to Dublin a few days early, on the Monday before classes began. Will and I were going to have our Christmas then. We planned to go on a bit of a road trip down the coast towards Wicklow and maybe stay in a B&B here and there. I'd been looking forward to it for weeks. But after being a plague-ridden burden for most of my stay at home, I felt guilty and elected to stay on there instead.
Will understood and we arranged just to have a weekend away instead. I booked a train for that Friday. But that was all forgotten, though, when on the Thursday morning, my mother knocked on my bedroom door to wake me up, poked her head in once I'd sleepily responded, and said to come downstairs. There'd been a girl found in the canal near St. John's. They were saying on the news that she was a student. Liz was waiting on the phone.
"It's Lauren," she said when I got on the line. "Claire's friend. She came out with us a few times." I wasn't even awake yet.
"What's Lauren?"
I asked through a yawn.
"It's her, Ali," Liz said. "On the news. She's the girl who's been murdered."
Allison, now.
"Ma'am,"
I said as soon as she answered her phone, "listen to me. Places we went to see in Dublin, where were they?"
"Hmm?"
My mother was distracted by something. I could tell by her voice.
"What? Allison, what's going on? I thought you'd ring me last night. Your dad's been waiting to talk to you. Where are you?"
I was running across the lawns outside the library, heading for Haddington Hall. I didn't think to look for Malone in the faces of the students milling about, or about how I was only drawing attention to myself by running across the grass, shouting into my phone. There was no time for that.
"Ma'am, listen. We went to look at places. Student accommodation, apartments, remember? With Liz. Because we didn't know if either of us was going to get a place at Hall's."
I was hurrying under the arch now, and could see Malone's car parked across the road.
"Where did we go, ma'am? Do you remember? There was a place in Rathmines, a tiny room in this really awful, dirty house. I think there was also an apartment, maybe. It was really expensive, though. And a house. There was a house with a tiny room up in the attic, and a young guy showed us around. His father owned it."
A horn blared as I darted between passing cars to get across the street.
"Is any of this ringing any bells? Where were those places?"
"Allison, what in the name of God is going on? You sound like you're being chased.
I'm going to get your dad. Hang on."
"No, don't, ma'am. Listen."
Malone wasn't in the car, and pulling on the passenger door handle told me it was locked.
"I need you to think about this, ma'am. Try to remember. It's important."
"Why?"
"I don't have time to explain. Just do it."
That sounded a bit harsh, so I added a, "Please." There was an electronic beep beep. Malone was coming towards me, pointing his keys at the car. I pulled the door open and got in.
"Ma'am, are you there?" "I'm thinking, Allison, I'm thinking."
The driver door opened and Malone sat in too. I mouthed "pen" at him and made a scribbling motion with my free hand. He pulled one from his pocket. I pulled the picture of CCTV man, Daniel, out of mine, turned it over to the blank side and took the cap off the pen with my teeth.
"Ma'am."
"What's going on?"
Malone whispered. I held up a finger to indicate that I'd tell him in a second.
"Okay," my mother said. "Well, the expensive apartment, I know where that was, Sandymount. We only went to see it because the man who owned it was a friend of your father's, Liam Keane. The bank owns it now."
My mother sounded inordinately pleased about that.
"It was never going to be a realistic option, that place, between you and me. I just wanted to nose around inside."
"Do you remember where in Sandymount?"
"In the village," she said. "It overlooked the little green there."
"Was it a new build?"
"Well, new-ish."
"Great."
I rolled my eyes. "Any other details?"
"There might have been trees right outside it."
I wrote these details down in the paper. Sandymount, new-ish. Trees?
"What about the other two we went to see?" I said. "Do you remember those?"
"Well, I don't know the name of the road in Rathmines, but it was a long line of red brick terraced houses, sort of curved at one end. That was the place with the awful bedsit, where you could flush the toilet and make your dinner at the same time. And what they were charging for it.
Near the canal or no?"
Near it, but not close enough to see it."
"So a street back from it?"
"At least."
"Anything else?"
"It could have done with being demolished. It was like something you'd see in Hoarders."
Rathmines. Red brick terraced. Curved street. Near canal. Hoarders.
"Okay, good. What about the other house, ma'am?" There was one with the room in the attic, I think.
That was out past Rathmines.
A pause.
Dartry, maybe?
Dartry. Do you have a street name or an estate?
No, my mother said. What is all this about?
What about the place itself? Do you remember anything about it that might help us find it now?
What do you want to find it for?
I'll explain everything later.
Is this to do with the murders?
Ma'am, please, there isn't time. I took a deep breath to keep myself from swearing, which would only set her off on a reprimand about that. I really just need you to answer the question. Do you remember anything else about the place in Dartry?
What about you? She said. What do you remember? Your mind was considerably younger than mine was back then.
But I didn't know Dublin at all. You did.
That's hardly going to help me with remembering what a house looked like from the outside now, is it?
I closed my eyes and tried to conjure up an image of the Dartry property, but all I could see was the house in Rathmines and a modern apartment block built by my imagination, overlooking a patch of grass in Sandymount Village.
There was a secret garden, my mother said then.
What?
A secret garden? Like the one in that film, the one with... Oh, what's her name? You know your one, with the teeth. I remember because I'd never seen one before. Not here, I mean. London, yes. Dublin, no.
Oh, what's the name of that film?
Mam, I said, forget about the film. Tell me about the garden.
Malone tapped me on the shoulder and whispered,
Speakerphone.
I'd forgotten he was there. I pulled the device from my ear and pressed the speakerphone icon.
One of those ones in the middle of all the houses,
my mother's voice said, booming now inside the car and accompanied by white noise that wasn't there when she'd just been in my ear.
With a big fence around it. You could only go in if you lived there. And it was just like in the film too, because there were all trees and bushes right up against the fence, so you couldn't even see in.
Oh God, what was the name of it?
I can see it, you know. I just can't think.
Notting Hill, Malone said.
That's it,
my mother shrieked.
Wait, who's that?
Detective Garda Malone, he said, leaning closer to me and so to the phone. We met yesterday, Mrs. Smith. You said the garden was in the middle of the houses. Does that mean the houses were arranged in a square all around it?
I don't think there were houses facing the main roads, my mother said. That was where you drove in, so maybe a U-shape or three sides of a square.
I added garden and U-shape / three sides to my list.
Okay, great, Malone said. So arranged around a fenced garden, but only on three sides. Were all the houses the same or were they different?
My mother made a hmm noise.
I'm not sure.
If you had to make a guess, which one would you pick?
I'd say they were probably the same. It was a small estate.
Old or new?
Am I guessing again?
Yes, Malone said.
Old then.
Same, small, old.
Do you remember anything else, Mrs. Smith?
No, sorry.
What's this about?
I'll call you later, I said, and explain everything, okay?
Why can't you explain it now? Where are you? And your father wants to talk to you.
Gotta go, ma'am. I'll call later, I promise.
Bye.
I pressed the end button on the phone and turned to Malone.
I have some questions too, he said with a half smile.
Hang on. I pulled out the business card Heather had given me and started tapping her office number into my phone. The call rang once, twice. I wondered if she'd pick it up when that girl who'd been waiting outside was probably sitting across from her right now. It rang a third time.
Heather Brookley,
a voice said then. Hey, it's me, Allison.
Well, that was quick.
Here's what I have. You ready?
Go.
A new apartment in Sandymount.
Sandymount?
Heather laughed.
I was a student, not a stockbroker.
Okay, next one. Red brick terrace in Rathmines, on a curved street, near the canal. Could that be the one you were talking about?
No, that was at the opposite end.
Last one, then. The rush of thinking I was onto something was fading fast. Houses arranged in a sort of U-shape around a fenced garden that only residents had access to. Somewhere in Dartry. Possibly the houses were,
yes,
all the same.
Wait, did you say yes?
Yes, I went to see a place like that. I don't remember the name of it, but it was near Trinity Hall, which is in Dartery, right? And I remember the garden because I thought it reminded me of the one in Notting Hill, I finished. Yeah. A pause. What does this mean?
I don't exactly know yet, but when I find out, I'll let you know. Thank you. I hung up and turned to Malone. Okay, the man in the CCTV images is Daniel O'Dowd. Heather knows him. He's her brother-in-law, in fact. He was in St. John's too back then, and nowadays he writes a blog all about the Canal Killer case. She's already had a visit from the Gardaí today, so the appeal must have worked. That's what Cusack told you this morning, isn't it? She said something about the news on the CCTV. Malone nodded.
Yeah. She told me they had a shortlist. His name was on it. They haven't picked him up yet, I don't think. He wasn't at home.
I don't think it's him. He's not the Canal Killer. He's just obsessed with the case, and with proving the killer isn't Will. I think he called me in my hotel room and sat outside my hotel and put that letter in my suitcase. But I don't think he killed those girls.
Malone's facial expression was neutral, giving nothing away about whether or not he believed this. Okay, he said. So what's all this about the houses?
Heather Buckley was attacked that September by the canal, by a man she says wasn't Will or Daniel, right? Then there were 5 victims, including Liz. All 6 of those girls had something in common. They were all waitlisted for a room in Halls, with only a small number of students overall ending up on the waitlist, and then getting a room after all. That's a big coincidence not to be some kind of connection. So what do they do that other students don't? They look for somewhere else to live, just in case. Liz and I, we went looking, because I was on the waitlist too. We were going to share if we didn't both get allocated a room.
But, Malone started,
I know, it's too random, because we're all going to look at different places, and we all use different methods to find them. There's ads in the newspaper, ads online, going into agencies, just hearing about places from other people. There's loads of ways. That's what I thought too, at first. But then I started thinking, there's actually not loads of properties. You want a place close to college, right? You want a place that's cheap. You can only look at places that are still available in the week or two before college begins, which alone dramatically narrows things down, now and back then. So what if all 6 went to see the same place, and that's the connection? What if they met the killer there?
Louise Farrington, Malone said. She was waitlisted for a room at Halls. I remember seeing the blue form in her file. I don't know about the other two, but... Jesus.
He was staring out the windscreen, looking a bit shell-shocked.
And with the Dublin rental market the way it is at the moment, this guy could be asking them to do anything. Even just for a viewing. Fill out forms, submit photo ID, provide bank statements.
And the way it is now is similar to the way it was then. We went to St. John's at the height of the boom, and now things are getting back on track here, right?
Malone nodded. Yeah, there's a queue of 50 people to see every half-decent bedsit.
And here's the kicker, I said. He's not their landlord. They don't see him again after the viewing, because they don't actually move in. They move into Halls instead, so it doesn't even look like a link. And now we know that Heather and Liz went to view the same place around the same time, the secret garden house in Dartery. I was there. I went with her. So if he was there, I might recognize him. We just need to find the house and hope he still owns it. Or, failing that, that whoever's there now can give us his name or something. Malone had turned around in his seat to face me.
This is good, Alison. This is really good.
He reached over me to open the glove box, retrieved a tablet computer from inside.
We need to find some Wi-Fi.
What about Will? I asked. Where does he fit into all this? I asked because I was thinking, I'm not sure he does anymore.
One thing at a time, Malone said, starting the engine. One thing at a time.
Alison, now. There happened to be a parking space by the cafe, a quaint little storefront with a vintage bicycle parked outside, and a white picket fence separating the outdoor tables and chairs from the street. It looked familiar. I think I used to come here, I murmured. Malone killed the engine and booted up the tablet computer. I frowned at him.
Aren't we going in? Let's check if we can pick up the Wi-Fi first. We may not have to.
I think they call that stealing, Garda Malone.
He grinned. We'll come back and buy something later if it makes you feel better. I checked my phone for messages. Sal had sent me one, looking for an update on yesterday's meeting with Will. My chest burned at the memory of that conversation, of how upset he'd been. If he'd really had nothing to do with this, then I really was responsible for him being in that place, for him being convicted of 5 murders, for him losing the last 10 years of his life. I pulled myself back from there, told myself we weren't sure of anything yet.
Should you tell someone what Heather said? I asked him. About Daniel. Like Shaw, I mean.
What did she say?
That he's an innocent, harmless.
Although I don't know about that. I mean, he did break into my hotel room to leave that letter. If that was him. But who else would it be?
And it's weird, isn't it?
A normal person would have just slipped it under the door. Didn't you say the Gardaí already spoke to her?
Yeah.
Then let's assume she told them too. I bet she did.
Malone was powering up the tablet.
And somehow I don't think her saying Daniel is harmless will have Shaw calling off the search for him, do you? Besides, there's another way of looking at it. Daniel is obsessed with a canal killer. He has a blog, a podcast, whatever, and he wants more people to notice it. So he uses his extensive knowledge of the original crimes to attempt to recreate them, thus bringing fresh attention to the case, thus bringing new readers to his blog.
This hadn't occurred to me.
Do you think that's what's happening? My feeling is no, Malone said. But you never know.
And she said her attacker definitely wasn't Will. So that torpedoes Shaw's theory that Will was part of a duo.
Well, I make a point of not telling Shaw he's wrong, so...
Where does he think you are right now?
Asleep in bed. I'm not in until later, so I can work tonight. I'm on canal duty.
Can we find out if Jennifer Madden and the one who's missing, Amy Boylan, isn't it? Can we find out if they were on the wait list for halls? And maybe get a list of places they viewed if they were?
I'll call Emily. Get her to do it. Right.
He was swiping at the tablet screen.
Let's do this. I'm going to start by googling Dartry's secret garden estate.
I raised my eyebrows at him.
What? He said. Maybe it'll be that easy.
It wasn't.
No luck, he said. It seems to think I'm actually looking for a dirty little secret in a garden, and all the results are tabloid stories about neighbours from hell.
Great. Well, Heather said it was near Trinity Hall, the Trinity College accommodation complex. Maybe try that and secret garden? More tapping.
Nope, Malone said then, swiping at the screen. Now it's all just stuff about Trinity Hall. What if we just look for it? Visually, I mean. On Google Maps. A garden with houses around it on 3 sides near Trinity Hall. Can't be that hard to find, surely. How many estates in Dublin have fenced-in gardens in the middle of them?
He leaned closer to me so I could see the screen better and opened the Google Maps app.
It automatically loaded at our current location. He started swiping, moving the map southwest. The green area stood out starkly against the white streaks of streets and the dull grey background. Immediately, I saw a problem.
The only green areas are really big ones, I said. Parks and golf courses. A little communal garden in the middle of a housing estate isn't going to show up on this. I shook my head.
Shit. Hang on. Malone tapped the screen. Let's try satellite view.
The screen changed to an intimidatingly detailed overhead shot, filled with what must be hundreds of tiny houses.
It looked a bit like a close-up of the circuits on a computer chip.
My heart sank. We'll never find it in all this.
Let's start at Trinity Hall and work out.
Malone zoomed in until we could make out the complex's accommodation blocks, and then started systematically searching the area around it. I looked too, but I couldn't make out anything that might be the estate we were looking for. Then,
there, Malone said, pointing. Could that be it?
On the map, to the east of Trinity Hall, was an approximately square patch of green filled with what looked like huge trees, a road encircling it, and facing that road were 8 houses? No, 16. They were semi-detached.
Maybe, I said. Can you do street view?
Malone tapped. The screen changed to an image of a street alongside a fenced-in green area. The houses were across from it, on the left. Malone tapped the screen again, angling the view towards the green. A thick hedge pressed up against the chest-high wrought iron railings, while beyond it, a dense network of tree branches and their leaves obscured all but a few patches of blue sky beyond. The screen moved again, shifting to the left. The view now was of a large gate in the fence, with a keypad mounted by the lock.
"That's it," I said. "I remember it."
"Doolin Gardens," Malone read. "Are you sure?"
"As sure as I can be, unless by some crazy coincidence there's a similar estate nearby."
We spent a few minutes scanning the map, but that was the only one of its kind we could find. All the others had open green areas with neatly mowed grass and no trees. We went back to Doolin Gardens. It looked to be about 3 streets from Trinity Hall, a 5-minute walk at most.
"Don't suppose you'd know which house?" Malone said.
"They all look the same, I doubt it. But let's do a loop with Street View just in case."
But they didn't all look the same. Most of them did, yes. Red brick, semi-detached, a bay window on the ground floor, and a dormer window in the highest. A small mature garden behind a low wall. More large trees dotted in almost every one. Shiny new front doors. Polished brass knockers. Proud homeowners inside, presumably. But one of them wasn't like all the others. One of them had a front door whose paint was peeling. What looked to be original windows left to rot and grow a thick, grimy film. A massive, overgrown tree in the front garden that completely blocked the bay window that must be hiding behind it. Plastic bins outside the front door with 23 written on them in white paint. Black refuse sacks poking out from beneath the lid. No garden gate at all and, in the gap left by its absence, a view of uneven paving slabs, being forced up from below and kept company by the weeds growing in the cracks.
"Well," Malone said, "we are looking for student accommodation. Let's see what happens when we Google the address."
The top result was a listing for a rental property, an attic studio, at 23 Doolin Gardens, Dartry, Dublin 6. There was a collage of 4 photos at the top of the screen, a view of a red brick semi-D with bay windows, a picture of a large double bed with a brightly patterned 2-seater couch backed up against it, a small but clean bathroom suite the colour of avocado, a tiny kitchenette with a dining table just big enough for 2, pressed up against a window, offering a view of the garden outside. The top of the tree in the house's own garden were brushing against the very bottom of the window pane.
"That's it," I said. "A shoebox right up in the attic. That's it."
Online it looked lovely. No wonder we'd gone to see it. There was no Google Street View back then to warn us off. These days, I presumed it was the demand-supply imbalance that still sent people to it. On the flight on the way here, I'd overheard the passengers seated in front of me, talking about how affordable rental properties were so scarce in Dublin, people on shift work were timesharing bedsits. The listing was marked as to let at €850 a month.
"That's not a bad price for that," Malone said. "That'll get people to come look. And it's a private letting, no agency involved."
He scrolled down the screen with the tip of an index finger. "There isn't even a first name on this, or a phone number. You can only contact the owner by messaging them through this site." He looked up at me.
"That alone is a bit suspicious."
"So what now?" Malone considered the question.
"Let's go there. Do a quick drive-by."
His phone beeped with a new text then.
"Shit," he said, reading it.
"What?"
"Daniel."
"What about him?"
"They found him at a house in Stillorgan," he sighed. "They're going in to arrest him right now."
He called in sick to work. Last night, he swallowed a sleeping pill before he went to bed and didn't set an alarm. Made sure the blackout curtains met each other and closed the bedroom door so no light would leak in from the landing. He let his body tell him how many hours of rest it needed, let sleep stay until all the hours of it he'd missed the night before had been replaced. It was nearly noon when he finally woke. He'd made some breakfast and taken it into his study, sitting the plate of hot buttery toast and cup of sweet tea down next to his laptop on his desk. Messy stacks of printed papers, pages torn from magazines and stories cut from newspapers take up the rest of the space. He boots up the computer and gets to what he likes to think of as his morning rounds, leaving sticky fingerprints on the keyboard as he works. He starts on the Beneath the Surface website, checking for new comments mostly. He likes to know what people are saying about the case. Sometimes he even responds to what they say, although always anonymously and only with thoughts that wouldn't draw any unwanted attention to himself. The latest post is, of course, about Amy. A commenter calling himself Derek0294 thinks it's too soon for the Gardaí to be dragging the canal, considering that Amy is so different to the other girls, what with her being last seen at St. John's Halls. He wants to leave a comment commending Derek0294 on this insight, but he doesn't think that would be a good idea. He moves on to news, puts Amy's name into Google and scans the results for the latest stories. He reads them quickly, scrolling constantly down the screen, as most of them contain the same details, only wrapped up or arranged differently. A theme he notices is emerging already. They're saying she vanished off the face of the earth. It's the last known sighting of her entering her own apartment that has them all shocked and confused. Apparently, another student passed her in the hall on the way in. They also have the electronic lock record, which shows she used her keys seconds later to gain entry to her place. He hopes they don't notice the lack of activity immediately after that, or that if they do, they'll mistake it for Amy turning in for the night. Not him, systematically deleting all entries he made with his own key, surreptitiously programmed in the security office during his very first shift. If St. John's have noticed deletions from the security cameras, they haven't let the press find out yet. He wonders for a moment if this is actually more effective than doing it along the canal. He has, from time to time, read subtext in the reporting of those ones like, "This is what happens to you when you walk home in the middle of the night, girls, drunk and alone." But Amy was at home, and at home because she elected not to go out drinking. She couldn't be any more blameless if she tried. He'll have to keep this in mind, although he doesn't want to deviate too much from the original blueprints. Still, little adjustments can be made if they serve the cause. Like the one he's going to make for Alison Smith. He didn't recognize her at first, her pinched face turned away from him on the front page of a Sunday paper. It was the headline that got him. Poring over the story at home, he put the pieces together. She had been that idiot guy's girlfriend, and it had been her friend who got herself added to the victim list. She was only a teenager at the time, this Alison. Not even he could blame her for being so stupid. But she was a woman of, what, 30 now? And visiting this guy in prison 10 years after the fact. He couldn't allow that. He eyes his black leather notebook within reach on the desk. Should he start a chapter on her? A quick internet search leads him to believe he'd have very little to add to it. He can find no social media accounts for her. And really, he only wants to talk to her. He doesn't need to demonstrate that her decisions may have terrible consequences when she's already quite effectively demonstrated that herself. He only needs to remind her of it. The doorbell rings. A 3-note electronic call that sounds foreign inside this house, followed by a sharp knock. He hurries downstairs to see who it is, still thinking of Alison, and maybe that's why he opens the door without looking through the peephole first. And when he sees who's on the doorstep, his heart leaps into his mouth and he thinks, "I should have looked. I should have checked. I shouldn't have answered." But it's too late now.
Alison, now. Outside my window, shop fronts were rushing by. We were on a kind of main street, packed with restaurants and boutiques. It had a village feel, and judging by the cool, expensive clothing I was seeing fly by on mannequins and windows, and the number of artisan coffee shops with pithy sayings on chalkboards set outside, everyone in the village had a lot of disposable income. Malone brought the car to a stop at an intersection, flicking on his right indicator. When I looked, I saw that across the street, on the other side of a lane of traffic going in the opposite direction, was a neat U-shaped row of red-bricked houses. A blue street sign had been set into the perimeter wall by the entrance. It said, Doolin Gardens, beside a box with a 6 in it, the postal code. There was a space just a house down from 23. Malone pulled into it, cut the engine. I turned to look at the house. It was exactly as it looked on street view. The only thing missing was the bins. That's it, I said. It looks exactly the same as it did online. I started unbuckling my seat.
Whoa, Malone said. What are you doing?
I looked to him. What?
We're staying in the car.
Why?
Because this could be the home of the serial murderer at the center of this investigation. We can't just go knock on the door. You, especially, cannot have anything to do with this. You're not only a civilian, but a potential witness. You could jeopardize the entire case if he does have something to do with it. We stay in the car.
I rolled my eyes frustrated. I wanted to get out, to do more, to be closer.
Then why did we come here? To verify it still looks like it did online. To check that there isn't a kid's bike in the garden and new windows in. To see if he still owns it.
How do we know that from sitting here?
Let's just watch for a few minutes.
I lasted no more than 10 seconds of sitting in silence.
Can't we go talk to the neighbors or something? I said then.
Malone shook his head.
No.
You let me talk to Heather.
I gave you a lift to St. John's so you could talk to an old college classmate. That's different.
I could pretend to be a prospective renter or something.
Allison, no.
Malone looked at me.
What's with you?
Momentum was what was with me. Figuring out the waitlist connection, talking to Heather, putting everything together. It felt like a rush, a flood of adrenaline that was still pulsing through my veins, urging me not to sit still, but to keep going, to keep moving. I didn't want to stop now. And somewhere below that, there was an undercurrent of anger, of frustration, of rage even, because a girl was missing, because she was the 8th one. Because it was becoming increasingly clear that what I'd thought for the last 10 years didn't match the truth, and I couldn't take a moment more of just waiting for the real story to emerge. And if the real story was different to the one I knew, then Will was somewhere he shouldn't be, and I was someone I shouldn't be. I wanted it to end. I said, I'm sorry.
I don't know what Malone thought I was apologizing for, but he started to smile and say, that's okay. I get impatient, but by then I depressed the handle on the passenger side door, pushed it open, and was getting out.
Allison! Allison!
I closed the door. The window was down a crack, and through it I said, I'm just going to knock on the neighbor's door. I can't just sit here. It'll be fine. I won't give my name.
Malone was hurriedly unbuckling his seatbelt.
Allison, get back in the car! It'll be fine! Allison!
I turned and started towards number 24. A few steps later, I heard a car door open and close, and footsteps rushing to catch up with me.
Allison, Malone said when he was alongside me. For God's, it'll be fine.
He shook his head. I didn't know him well enough to be able to tell if he was mad, but I thought I could take an educated guess. He was furious with me. But it was too late. We were on number 24's garden path now. Bundling me back into his car would draw more attention. Through the house's bay window, I could see a sliver of the living room, a large TV screen fixed to the chimney breast, and a leather chair sitting to one side of it, its back to a built-in bookcase. The front door was painted a glossy emerald green and had a 2 and a 4 affixed to it in polished brass, below a frosted windowpane. I pressed the doorbell and a short musical note sounded in the house.
We shouldn't be doing this, Malone said. You shouldn't. I should have stopped you.
I could see movement through the frosted glass, a dark, blurry shape growing bigger.
You don't have to do anything, I said. Let me do the talking.
What are you going to say?
We could hear footsteps on a hard surface, coming closer.
It'll be fine, I whispered. It's just a neighbor.
The door opened and a man I would have guessed to be in his mid to late 30s appeared. The hallway behind him was dark. A small gut was pushing against the material of his T-shirt, making a bid for freedom over the waistband of his jeans. He appeared sleepy, his hair sticking out at odd angles. He was looking at us both questioningly for a moment, then stared at me. "We're sorry to bother you," I said. "This is a bit awkward, but we're trying to track down one of your neighbours. Your next-door neighbour, actually. He owns the house next to us, and his tenants are driving us crazy. Parties all night, rubbish in the garden. Honestly, it's been a nightmare." I nodded towards the tree in 23's garden. "I think you might know what I'm talking about." The man glanced toward the house next door, but said nothing. I could feel Malone's eyes on me. "The thing is, we can't get him on the phone. You wouldn't happen to have a number for him, would you?" The man's mouth was hanging open. He turned to Malone, looked him up and down, looked back to me, blinked rapidly. "Yeah," he said then. "I probably have a phone number somewhere." He rolled his eyes. "For that useless fecker." "You know him then?" "To see. To wave at. Not well." "What's he doing with that tree?" I jerked my head towards the monstrously overgrown one in the garden of 23. "Don't get me started," the man said. "The roots are actually coming in here now, under the wall." He pointed out the damage. A crack of daylight in the middle of the low brick divider between the two gardens. "It single-handedly brings down the average house price in this estate, but there's just no talking to him."
"No need to tell me that," I said, making a face to go with it. "How long has he had the place here?"
"We're not too bad. He only just bought the one next to us a few months ago."
10, 11 years, maybe," the man said.
I had to consciously not react to this.
"His father had it before him, but he used to look after it. Nice man, his father was."
"So he owns the whole house?"
"Yeah."
"I thought he might just have one of the units in there." The man frowned.
"Units?"
I looked towards number 23. "Isn't it divided up?"
"No," the man said. "Not that I know of."
He turned to go back inside.
"Let me get you that number. Hang on a second."
Malone and I exchanged a glance. He shook his head just once to indicate that we shouldn't talk. Moments later, the man returned with a mobile phone number scribbled on a piece of paper.
"Here you go."
He passed it to me. His fingers brushed mine and I took it from him. His hand was warm. "Thanks so much for this," I said, taking a step back. "We really appreciate it."
"What's your name?"
the man asked me. I was thrown by this and hesitated, and then I realized how suspicious that was, and since it was the first girl's name that wasn't my own, inappropriate as it may be, I blurted out, "Amy." I could feel Malone tense up beside me.
"Amy," the man repeated slowly. "I'd never have guessed. You don't look like an Amy."
"Don't I?" I smiled tightly. "What does an Amy look like?"
"Is he around here much?" Malone said. "We don't see him around our place very often."
The man frowned.
"What do you mean? He's here all the time."
He pointed next door at number 23.
"He lives there."
Allison, now. It made perfect sense when you thought about it. A rental property he never actually rented out. He wasn't the landlord there, but the resident. Living there and also showing it to accommodation-seeking students as if he wasn't, as if no one was. Malone had turned a paler shade at the very thought that the guy, the killer, was inside that house at this very moment, potentially seeing him and I outside, and I had, in turn, felt a hot stone of guilt settle in my stomach for not obeying Malone's instructions to just stay in the bloody car. But then number 24 said number 23 was likely to be at work. He didn't know what his neighbour did for a living, but he seemed to work weekdays and wore a suit. We thanked him and hurried back to the car.
"I shouldn't have used Amy," I said. "It was just the first name that popped into my head."
All Malone would say is, "Let's just get out of here."
Once back in the driver's seat, he tapped his phone screen and put it to his ear. He started the engine, threw the car in gear.
"Em, it's me. Listen."
While he filled her in, my thoughts strayed to Will. I wondered what he was doing right now. I imagined going to see him again, telling him that we'd found the canal killer. The real one. But had we?
A wave of nausea came over me. I turned towards the window and closed my eyes, waiting for it to pass. The ground felt unsteady, everything did, like plates were shifting fast beneath my feet, and everything on them, my whole life, was threatening to move and change. This guy could just be a copycat. But why copy a killer who'd been caught? And why now, after all this time? Why not just go and do your own evil thing? Unless Will and him were working together. But how would that work? They started as a tag team. Now this guy was going solo. Why? And again, why now? What had he been doing all the years in between? And was Daniel really just wrong place, wrong time? Or was he involved in the murders in some way? If he was, how did he and Number 23 fit together? And how did they tie in with Will? I groaned inwardly. There were no answers, only more questions. I was literally sick of asking them. Okay, yeah, Malone was saying. I will. I will. All right, bye. He ended the call and twisted the steering wheel, pulling the car out of its parking space. He drove the rest of the way around the U-shape of Doolan Gardens and turned into the city-bound traffic on the main road. What's happening? I asked. They have Daniel O'Dowd in custody. Shaw is looking for me. He and I are going to do the interview. With one hand, he tapped his phone again, put it to his ear, waited through what sounded like a voice message. Sarge, it's me. Cusack passed on your message. I'll be at the station within the hour, and I'm on this number in the meantime. He tapped the screen. The phone locked with a click. What did Cusack say about Number 23? She's checking property records. She also thinks I'm actively trying to lose my job. Malone's phone rang. He glanced at the screen. It's Shaw, he said to me. Into the phone. Malone. I could hear Shaw's voice, but not the individual words. At first, Malone was nodding and saying, yeah, periodically. Then, I have Alison Smith with me. Did Cusack tell you? Yeah. Yeah, I know. That's what I thought too. Okay. Okay, yeah. Right, will do. He ended the call, turned to me. He's going to call me when the warrant comes in. So what now? We wait. Maybe M will come up with something on Number 23 before the interview with Daniel starts. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. What about you? I could drive you out to Bray. I thought of Malone's balcony, the peaceful view from it. Could I just wait at yours? It's closer and it doesn't have my mother in it. I was relieved to see him grin at this. I like your mother, he said. But sure. Sorry about back there. It's okay, Malone said after a beat. No harm done. We drove back to his place, each lost in our own private silence. As we arrived, Shaw called again to tell Malone to come in for three. It was just past noon by then. We'd picked up fast food drive-through for lunch and sat in front of Malone's TV with it, staring vacantly at the screen. Neither of us could have recalled any detail of what we were watching, not even if our lives depended on it. At some point, I fell asleep. I dreamed of us all. Will and I, Liz, Heather, Daniel. We were all in the water, and something was pulling on our ankles, dragging us down. The water ran up my nose and down my throat, and reached into my lungs and squeezed, and I couldn't breathe. I can't breathe. And someone was screaming. I opened my eyes. Malone was shaking me, and after a moment of sheer terror, when I didn't know where I was or whose arms were around me, I realized that they weren't constricting me, but supporting me. And we were sitting so close, and I could only look at him. Not quite at his face, but down at his chest, and a heat bloomed between us, and his arms closed around me, pulling me in, and it felt like melting, like disappearing, or everything else disappearing. And I breathed in deep, pulling him in, and he pulled me closer. And then his phone rang, breaking the spell, and reality came rushing back like a slap. I was so mortified I couldn't think. Every blood cell in my body was making a beeline for my face. Meanwhile, Malone just answered his phone like a normal person. It was Cusack. I was sitting close enough to hear every word. Bad news, she said. Oh, great. Malone rubbed at his eyes. He looked like he might have dozed off too.
Go on.
The property at 23 Doolin Gardens is registered to a Mr. and Mrs. Thomas and Margaret O'Rourke, with an address in Ennis. They actually own number 24 as well. Landlords. Landlords currently not answering their phone. I can only go back 15 years before I have to go looking for physical records, but it's been in their name all that time. So whoever lives there isn't an owner-occupier. But he could be related to Mr. and Mrs. O'Rourke, I suppose. Or he could just rent off them. I ran the address through Pulse, but nothing came up. The utility bills would tell us more, but I'd need a warrant for them. And trust me when I say nothing is happening here that isn't related to Daniel O'Dowd right now. So you're shit out of luck on that front.
Great.
Malone shook his head.
What's the other bad news?
The telephone number his neighbour gave you was a dud. It belongs to a researcher on a radio show in Limerick City. The radio station pays for the phone, and were happy to email me a scan of their most recent bill. It all checks out.
Malone looked at me. I whispered, double check?
The note was in Malone's pocket. He unfolded it now and called out the number again. Cusack had taken it down correctly. I held out my hand and he passed the note to me. The digits were clear. This wasn't a handwriting error. The guy must have given his neighbour the wrong phone number on purpose.
Okay, Malone said. Well, thanks for all that, Em.
I'm not done with the bad news.
He sighed. Go on.
The address wasn't in Pulse, she said, but I did find it somewhere else. Shaw was getting me to cross-reference all the names that came into us during the original investigation with the ones we've been getting in now, in response to the CCTV appeal. He sent me an Excel spreadsheet prepared by one of the analysts, and get this, the address was on that. Someone put together this waitlist property search connection back in 2007 and compiled a list of properties each of the girls had viewed, but it stopped there. I think they got Will Hurley then, and the property connection wasn't explored any further. Malone looked at me and I looked away. If this was the same guy, they had him back in 2007, or were about to get him, until I corrected my statement and pulled them off the trail. I felt sick. I put a hand to my mouth, worried that I would be. Then I felt Malone's hand on my other hand. I let him turn it over, lock his fingers into mine, squeeze it once, tight. I dared look at him. His face was full of sympathy. He'd tell me it wasn't my fault, I knew. But that's